Welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and all things lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Nice try, Lynn. Lynn likes to slip things in to see if I read them. Today, we continue with our monthly segment on arts and culture curated by the Park City Summit County Arts Council. We talk about how arts and culture is supported in our community with director Hadley Dynick and arts enthusiast Julie Hopkins.
And then it's the North American Handmade Bicycle Show. It's taking place this weekend at the Salt Palace Convention Center. We'll speak with several people from the show, and that is cool stuff.
Finally, we talk about how we can effectively capitalize on the latest advancements in cognitive science to regulate emotions, sharpen focus, break old habits, and develop new ones, learn more efficiently, and make better decisions. Sounds like we're
going to
have it
need.
All figured out yeah. after this interview. We speak with book author Frederic Fabricius. Her book is called The Leading Brain, Powerful Science Based on Strategies for Achieving Peak Performance.
This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital with New Park Town Center. With urban amenities and services and home to restaurants, shops, entertainment, lodging, and residences. More information about New Park Town Center at 801-303-5440.
Hi, I'm Davey Ratchard from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all Park City Mountain events can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Miller Orthodontics is a proud supporter of The Randy Barton Show. Since 1988, my wife and I have provided a combined 45 years of orthodontic care. For our Invisalign patients, we provide digital scanning and imaging technology that eliminates the need for wet molds of your teeth. More information is at m2ortho.com.
And we're back with The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Now, we kicked off 2017 with a monthly segment on the role of art and culture in our mountain town. In our first segment, we discuss the art of conversation, how our arts and culture programming provides a foundation for considering different ways of thinking and a reference point for talking about issues with each other. In February, we focused on the art of inspiration, and in honor of the Children's Illustrated Book Month, I believe it was, we highlighted our local children's book writers and illustrators who find inspiration in our mountain lifestyle, namely Corinne Humphrey. And this month, we're inviting Avid's arts and culture supporter and local businesswoman, Julie Hopkins, to share her perspective on arts and culture and the value it provides. She's joining us now in the studio, along with Summit County Arts Council Executive Director Hadley Dynack. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Lynn.
Great to have you. So, I don't know, let's just ask the basic question, Julie. Why arts and culture, and how does it weave into your business as a local realtor?
Oh, well, that's a good question, and it's one I've been contemplating since Hadley asked me a few days ago. And I think it goes back to being a child and growing up in Aspen, Colorado. And I think there's two ski towns in the United States that have the same history, which is Aspen and Park City, that started out as historic mining towns and it evolved into these world-class ski resorts. And I was fortunate to grow up in Aspen and now live in Park City. And I think we can all agree that they've kind of evolved into different characters now as we sit here in 2017. And I think we all choose to live in Park City because we like the character of this town and the people and what it's become. But being a child in Aspen in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it shaped who I am and how I think about the arts. And there was a man named Walter Pepke and his wife Elizabeth who really shaped Aspen, and they started the Aspen Ski Company, the Aspen Music Festival, and the Aspen Institute, and they really believed in the arts as making a complete life. So they believed in, you know, sports and arts, and that's what layered a town. And that the arts flourished your soul and completed your soul. And I grew up with that. Mm-hmm. And so as a kid, I was thinking about this, and I hadn't really thought about it till last night. You know, I grew up on the Aspen ski team, as everyone did, and that was the cool thing, and I loved it, and I flourished in that. And you would go to ski practice Saturday, Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. And then I had this fabulous mom who would come pick me up after ski practice and take me to cello lessons. You know, I played classical cello. I played jazz saxophone. I was on the choir and in the school plays. And I had this whole cultural side of my life. And that's because that was the character of Aspen and the tone that the Pepke set for that town. And I think that's just how I grew up. And I've always believed that about the arts. And I'm so thrilled that Park City has grown up with the arts as well, and that it's becoming a bigger part of our community. Because we had the 2002 Olympics, and we're all very sports enthusiasts here, but the arts are becoming a bigger part of this town. And we, the people that live here, are finding it more and more important to find that same balance. And so
it's so interesting to me to hear you talk about it, and I realize that Aspen had its art and culture world mm-hmm. developed far sooner than Park City. But in some ways, I think that we go through life in this town that's a resort town and which is focused on our sports,
right.
Our outdoor lifestyle, our skiing, our mountain biking, our hiking, our golf. And we're very focused on how to refine those. But arts and culture is just kind of a given, I think. A lot of us don't think about how to refine those avenues, much like it sounds has been done for decades now uh-huh. in Aspen. Either one of you can comment on that. I mean, are we starting to refine it more? I think we must be.
Well, I would argue that, you know, we have an incredible arts and culture community here. And, you know, we have organizations that are programming world-class celebrity performers on our stages. We've got this incredible film festival that brings the best in independent thinking and media to our town in January. And then we've got so many emerging and established local artists that I think really round out a continuum of arts and culture that's pretty spectacular. I think that, you know, over the last 30-some years, the arts and culture organizations in our community have been very scrappy. I think they've had a vision, and yeah. I think that they have put their attention on these kind of leaders in our community that have invested in their organizations and grown them. And so now we're at a point where we have this kind of very organic arts and culture sector, I think, and a growing creative industry sector with lots of local makers that are producing locally grown goods. And so I'm really excited to spend the next year thinking about how to craft a roadmap for the future to support all of these different organizations in the trajectory and growth in our community.
You know, there's so many different threads to this conversation, just that topic that you hit on, Julie, and I don't even know how to kind of deconstruct them, but I'd like to a little bit. I'd like to attempt, because, you know, the Pepkes in Aspen, mm-hmm. who were the driver, they combined art and sport and a resort community, which
right.
is kind of an amazing thing to have done that long ago to build the character of the community.
Correct.
And we've done it, as you just said, Hadley, in a somewhat scrappy, organic fashion. But at the same time, we've had Sundance, which is a big driver. So,
absolutely.
You know, and I guess my question, Julie, would be, having been in Aspen and seen what the Pepkes did and having come to Park City, did you walk into Park City and go, huh, there's a void here? Or did you walk into Park City and say, God, there's an amazing opportunity here? And it's similar to when I came in 92 and I said, you know, there's not a race to the top of the mountain in this town. That's really bizarre. There should be one.
Right.
And now there is, you know,
right.
the Jupiter Peak steeplechase. And we all sort of take that for granted. But what, you know, were there barriers? Would Aspen be the same place if the Pepkes weren't there? Would it have happened in a more scrappy, organic fashion? Or did they have to be there?
I think the Pepkes had to be there. They had the vision and they were the leaders in the community and they started all those organizations. We're here. We are so lucky that we have, since we're talking about arts, we have amazing leaders of our art organizations.
We've got some scrappy folks, Randy Barton, Terry Orr.
Well, I'm really impressed with what they've done and how they've gone out and found funding because it takes funding to pull all this off. And then they've had the vision and they've pulled it up to where it is today. Absolutely. And I'm impressed with it. I think they've done a good job and they're putting Park City on the map in terms of arts. And then our galleries. I mean, we have people that come to Park City specifically to buy art. So I think we're getting there.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny when we talk about Randy Barton, and now it has been maybe a year and a half since he came before City Council and the Summit County Council and said, you know, presented this thing that said, we need a master plan for arts and culture. It is as important as our whole sporting culture. And it seemed like an aha moment. To me, it was so interesting that you need that aha moment to realize, oh, yeah, good point. And so since he did that, the movement has, what, accelerated? Have you, Julie, as a business person, seen more people doing what you do, selling real estate here in Park City, kind of embracing that? Like, this is really important, and this is a part of how we market ourselves?
In terms of the arts,
how we market ourselves? Yeah, the arts and culture.
Yeah. So, you know, we used to sell real estate to people who just wanted ski properties. And now we are selling real estate to people who want the full package. They come here for the summers. You know, they come here for the concerts, for the art, and skiing. You know, it's not just a ski town anymore. It's a full service town, if you would, for all aspects of it. So for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit. Oh, go ahead, Hallie.
I was just going to add that, you know, we often talk about the value of arts and culture in terms of its intangible benefits, the beauty that it, or the inspiration that it provides, the community connection that we get as a result of it, the quality of life benefits. But I think that there's some very specific economic benefits that arts and culture have in our community. And, you know, in terms of the jobs that it provides, in terms of the kind of connection to other things that people do when they come to a performance. They go to dinner, perhaps. They go to explore some of our galleries. And also thinking about the impact on things like appreciation of real estate or real estate value. So I think that the economic side of arts and culture in our community is an important one.
Yeah.
Do either of you worry at all about, you know, how we brand ourselves, how we market ourselves? And I fully am in agreement with what you said about the more complete package of who we are as a community. And that speaks to the character of the community, the different components that are in the equation that end up on the other side of the equal sign that says, this is what our community is and looks like.
Yeah, many layers.
Yeah, but then we get into the, you know, the marketing side and the branding side. And we've seen problems with that where somebody comes in and says, yeah, you guys do have a brand and you do have a name and we're going to register it. You know, and that presents, in my mind, a lot of problems when you start talking in terms of the branding of the community, which I know is off topic with arts, but art plays a role in that, and it's going to play an increasingly important and heavily weighted role in the future, I believe, as we shift away from purely sports and recreation into a more complete character of the community.
Right.
Does that worry you? I mean, because you do sell Park City.
You sell Park City as a whole, absolutely. But I guess I'm here more as a purist than trying to think of, you know, how we're branding the community. I guess I'm looking at it more as, you know, how things have evolved and how we're trying to find balance in the community versus maybe, you know, how one entity is trying to brand it. I'm looking at it more as who we are, who's the character of the community and how it's evolving, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what your thoughts are, Hadley.
I don't know what my thoughts are on that either. I mean, I think that, you know, the idea of this conversation was to really think about from a business perspective and from a major supporter's perspective on how the arts and culture play a role in impacting our community.
Well, if you look at it from a purely business perspective and you follow the money, because that's what, you know, that's what business people say, just follow the money and you'll learn everything, right?
Right.
Right. So look at where our Chamber Bureau spends their money and look at the videos that they put together. And those videos are evolving. They are becoming Absolutely. More complete. They're Yes. talking about summer activities Yes. and they're talking about a broader spectrum of activities Right. instead of just the ski package. So that's interesting to see that shift occur.
You're correct.
But we are definitely selling Park City, the name and the brand and the marketing of Park City, to the rest of the world. And it's, you know, come here with these really amazing 45-second videos that you sit and look at and go, yikes, that's really effective and people are going to come here increasingly. So, I, you know, from a business perspective, there's an awful lot of money going into the branding and marketing of Park City.
You're correct. You're correct. And I think we've seen it this year with more people in the town than ever before.
So does it come down to who comes to visit us? If they're going to go to the up and down Main Street and visit our galleries, is that a different type of clientele, a different guest who comes here? Do they spend, you know, Hadley, different amounts of money, that group, when they're coming for arts and culture versus just a ski vacation?
Well, I think that absolutely. And, you know, we're seeing people that come for lots of different reasons. You know, they come to ski and then they come for amazing restaurants that are, you know, we're continuing to have new culinary art scene that is impressive here. We've got these performers that, you know, are being programmed on main stages, and then these local acts that are being performed in you know, smaller venues around town. So I think that there's a whole package of services
And I think one thing that's unique about Park City is we appeal to people of all different economic levels. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about that and who is it bringing, is that there's something for everybody of an economic level in Park City. You know, we're not just Aspen that's appealing to one economic level. And mm-hmm. I think that's unique about our town and really wonderful, too.
Interesting point. Mm-hmm. We've got just a minute left, and this is probably a longer conversation, but I want to talk about public art. And I have heard some gallery owners lament that we need more public art and we don't have it. And if you go to the Bear Bench at any time of the day or night, there are people sitting by the bear taking photos. But it's kind of the only thing we have that's like that. Maybe I'm not thinking of all of our public art, but you know, where people come there and instead of taking pictures of the mountains, they're taking pictures of the bear on the bear bench. How do we get more of that? Do we need more of that? What are the barriers?
Well, I do think that's a longer conversation. In fact, I was going to propose that both the Summit County and the Park City Public Art Board representatives come next month and talk about some of the participatory public art projects Great. That they're doing. So let's make sure that we do that. You know, I think that there's actually a surprising number of public art pieces in Park City. So next month we can talk a little bit more about that. There's one project, though, that I would like to just put out there right this minute because there's a short window for the public to participate. And it's a new project. It's actually the second version of a project that the Summit County Public Art Board is doing called The View from My Door. And the idea is to ask Summit County residents to think about the sense of place and home that they have and submit a photograph literally from their door or metaphorically from a place that represents their home. The website is darkstorefronts.org. You can learn more about it and you can submit photographs, which will then be designed into large format posters that will go in commercial spaces across the county. The deadline is next Friday, the 17th. So check that out and think about how you can contribute to a participatory community-created public art piece.
A great way to contribute. Again, it's darkstorefronts.org if you're interested. All the information is there. Yep. Hadley Dynack, Park City Summit County Arts Council, and Julie Hopkins, local arts enthusiast, supporter, patron, and realtor. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You.
And speaking of arts, we're speaking next with some folks who are putting on the North American Handmade Bicycle Show. It's taking place this weekend, or starting Friday. I'm looking right now at this amazing photo of a wood fat bike with these incredible curves. That's art.
That's art.
That's the blending of our two, the sports and the art. Excellent. When we return, it's The Mountain Life.
Hi, this is Chris Eggleton.
And Chris Retzer of Destination Hotels Utah, proud sponsor of KPCW.
Since 2005, we've provided nightly rental, retail, and community management services
to New Park Town Center, Prospector Square, Empire Pass, and Touhe.
More information about Destination Hotels Utah is at dhutah.com.
Experience the ride of a lifetime on the Comet bobsled ride at the Utah Olympic Park. Our professional pilots take passengers on a thrilling ride down the 2002 Olympic track. In less than a mile, you'll rip through curves, hitting top speeds like an Olympic athlete. It's an adrenaline rush not to be missed. Reservations required. Details and restrictions are available online at utaholympiclegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a KPCW supporter and a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, the North American Handmade Bicycle Show showcases the talents of individuals around the world whose art form is the bicycle. It aims to be a meeting point for frame builders and cycling enthusiasts looking for perhaps custom-made bikes, for the sharing of ideas and the promotion of a special industry with a rich history actually dating back to 1819. This year will be the 12th year of the North American Handmade Bicycle Show. It begins on Friday at the Salt Palace Convention Center. It's open to the public, and if you love bikes, even if you're not looking for a handmade bike and you just want to see this art in action, don't miss this show. We're joined today by Don Walker and Steve Elms. They're with the show. Don Walker is the show's director. And welcome. Thanks for coming up to Park City to talk about your show.
Oh, thank you very much for having us.
So was that right? The 12th year?
Actually, 13. This is number 13.
Okay. And have you done it in Salt Lake every year, or does it move around?
It moves around nationally. We've been all over the country. This is our first year here, and we're really excited about it.
Oh, great. Exciting stuff. So I pulled up this photo that I just can't even believe this is real, but it is. It's a wooden framed fat bike with a dark wood inlay. And it's incredible. I wouldn't even be able to begin to explain what this is, but it really is incredible. So talk about the numbers of bikes that will be there in the different categories.
Oh, there will be hundreds of bikes. The different categories, we've got, obviously road, mountain, track, cyclocross, tandems. We've got gravel. Gravel is a huge and up-and-coming, category of bicycles. Obviously fat bikes. So there's, no shortage of styles of bicycles, that'll be on the show floor. And each and every one of them is basically rideable art.
Yeah, we have we have 182 vendors this year, and despite the name being the North American Handmade Bike Show, we've always had international presence, and this is our largest. We'll have over 20 international builders from Russia, Singapore, Japan,
Korea this
UK.
Year.
So, it's a real celebration of the art form, and some of them are true, the bike that you're looking at right there are true rideable works of art. And the nice thing is some of them are actually built to pretty much be museum display pieces. Like, the builders will work on these bikes for, upwards of a year, handcrafting lugs and things like that. Because this is, for their ability to be able to sort of work with the public and meet potential customers. So it's an intersection of commerce and art and celebrating a great form.
And so will bikes be for sale at the show, or are they just on display?
Typically, they're not for sale. If you are, in the market for a bike, you have a choice of, up to 100 different builders to go and interview, and you find somebody that actually works, fits your, style, your aesthetic that you're looking for, and you place an order. So somebody might have a bike for sale on the show that, somebody could walk up and go, hey, I think that might fit me. Okay, well, let's, work out the details. And, Sunday afternoon when the show closes, somebody, walks off the show floor with a brand new bike.
Well,
so that does happen.
Probably a good thing, because I was thinking as somebody who might just walk in there and doesn't necessarily need a bike, but be so taken with what they're seeing.
Oh, we have a whole
they
service
could walk out
to hold
with
your
a handful
credit
of
cards
bikes.
For you. Yeah. We have a new service this year. We'll hold your credit cards for you.
Oh, that's good.
Now, that part about, functional art, is every bike that is produced could it be called functional art? Is it a work of art? Or are some of these indistinguishable from production bikes? If you looked at them side by side, you wouldn't know one from the other.
It's an excellent question. I will say you would. My background back in the 90s was in frame building. So I have a history in this. So it's fun to be back and working with Don. I would say that you can always discern a handmade bike from a production bike. And a lot of it stems from the relationship that you're having with the builder. And there's an interesting sort of backlash taking place in our sort of semi-disconnected society these days, where you can go to Amazon and order everything, where people are actually coveting interaction with those that they want to buy things from. So it's why you're seeing sort of these maker fairs and things like that, a resurgence of this farmers markets and stuff like that, is because in 90% of our waking day, it's Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, which we're all on.
Yeah.
And it works and it serves a purpose. But a lot of people who covet handmade bike shows covet the experience, because your body's getting measured and you're selecting, you know, the paint job, and you're trusting this craftsman to say, I understand your riding style. I understand what you want to achieve with the bike. I'm going to blend the tubes using my knowledge as a frame builder and what I learned from the person that taught me and taught that person and the tubing suppliers. So really it's unlike anything you'll get in that sort of production facility. Not say anything bad about production bikes. There's a lot of wonderful ones out there. But we just feel like we're offering something a little bit more.
That's such a great point that you bring up, how we're craving that you talk about. I want to also talk about some of the, you know, we know the bike companies that are production companies. You know, most of us here in town have a mountain bike from one of those. And then there are those companies that seem to be fairly high production, but they're all custom. And I cannot think of the name of the company in Steamboat Springs.
Be Moots or...
Yeah, something like Moots. So
Moots,
talk a little
Erickson.
Bit about that midway where it is somewhat production, but it's all custom. How many bikes a year are those kind of companies putting out there?
That's a great question. I'd have to talk to the guys there, mm-hmm. but I believe they're somewhere in the neighborhood between 500 and 1,000 bikes a year.
Okay.
And possibly even more.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a good level to be at, because you're constantly, you know, the turnover, you know, getting bikes in and out, or the orders coming in and the bikes going out is really, really fast. And that's great.
Well, and one of the things that those types of companies accomplish is they get the word out among us consumers that, wow, having a custom made bike is really a great thing. Mm-hmm. So are those kind of companies at the show, or are they, I'm trying to get a grasp on, are these one-offs? Is it someone who just makes bikes in their garage that shows up, or is it?
No, it's there's a blend of both. You got some hobbyist builders that will be occupying what we call the new builder table row, and those are the guys that have yet to make 50 bikes in their career. They might only be doing you know, 2 or 3 bikes a year, but, you know, some of them might be doing 10 or 12. But once you hit 50, that's kind of the breakthrough level of, you know, really getting your chops, understanding what the metal is going to do when you put heat to it, et cetera. And then there's, you know, shops that have been around, you know, like Moots and the Ericssons and stuff like that, that, you know, have several thousand bikes in their, you know, repertoire, so to speak, of or how many they've produced. And, you know, those shops and everything in between, really. You know, I myself make about 30 bikes a year. You know, there's guys out there that are doing, you know, 50, 60 a year on average. So there's everything in between, you know, the ones and twos all the way up to the, you know, 1,000 or so.
This is so great. We're talking with the folks from the North American Handmade Bicycle Show. It's taking place Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Salt Palace Convention Center. Friday and Saturday, I think it's 10 to 6, and Sunday a bit shorter, right?
10 to 5 on Sunday,
10
yes.
to 5 on Sunday. You can go to their website, which is just the acronym for the long title, nahbs.com, to buy tickets. No doubt you can buy tickets at the door. Mm-hmm. I love to hear about materials. Are we building bikes out of graphene yet? So what are the new cool materials?
Well, the new stuff is really not all that new, but carbon fiber seems to be the wave of the future. And a lot of people are switching over to making out of carbon fiber. I myself am actually considering doing it. I've been building in steel for 25 years. I'm also considering doing titanium. I've got a TIG welder. I've threatened to do it, but I just haven't gotten around to doing it.
It's a whole new world.
It really is. And then, you know, the other materials, there's renewable stuff. There's wood. And bamboo, and those seem to be, you know, I don't want to say so much fringe materials that because they are gaining in popularity, but they are definitely beautiful when you see them.
Yeah, there's a storied history, obviously, with steel and even titanium. Carbon fiber is certainly becoming more, people are more understanding of it. You know, the newer the material, the more time it takes people to really understand and fine-tune riding characteristics and quality. And, you know, people still oftentimes go back and we'll talk about a custom bike and how it rides as if it was a steel bike. You know, that's because that's the longest history material with most of it. So, but you'll see a mix, and you'll see a mix of building styles, you know, lugged frame, brazed frame, TIG welded frames. So there's a variety and blending of materials, carbon fiber and titanium and steel. And so,
yeah, when you guys are done here, you should walk down the sidewalk to, actually have to go to Main Street or cut through, but at the Bear Bench Plaza, mm-hmm. That area, there is a, bike rack made out of bamboo from one of our local, bamboo users in town, Soul Poles. They make, ski poles out of bamboo.
Nice.
And the city contracted with them for a pilot program of, functional public art, which is a bamboo bike rack, and it's installed down there, so you might get a kick out of seeing that.
Yeah, that'd be great. Definitely.
And there must be a relationship between price and production. The number of, you know, the hobbyist who is doing it, you know, for kicks, I guess, but then the person who's actually making a living at this, and if it takes so long to build a bike and they can only put so many out the pipeline, you know, annually, do they have to charge a whole bunch more, or is it relatively in the same ballpark of production bicycles? And I guess, you know, you're paying a premium for art in some respects, or are you?
That's a great question as well. I look at it as the more experience you have, the more you can charge for your work. The better reputation you have, the more you can charge for your work. The newer guys don't charge as much because they're the new guys.
I think it's an ongoing discussion in the industry regarding the value of a custom bike, and you know what the market will bear is always a good way to look at it, especially for a newer frame builder. But to Don's point, oftentimes when you're first getting started, the bikes you're selling are to your friends who are willing to say, "I understand what I'm getting is sort of your practice bike, and it's gonna and it takes a long time." I mean,
I understand the welds may come apart.
But we won't go that far. But you know,
we hope not.
So, but you know, when you look at, you brought up Moots earlier, and the only difference really between Moots and a lot of the other frame builders out there is they're a collection of frame builders who have broken down the process into oftentimes steps. That allows them to increase their volume, but it is still very much a handmade bike. If you still go into their facility, it's just a larger version of what Don, who's a single frame builder, and might have some apprentices working under, has. Same frame jig, same production process. They've just been able to scale, but still, they're very much a handmade bicycle.
Okay, this is such a great conversation. I'm excited to go. You want to go with me?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was just afraid I was going to walk out with a handful of bikes that
How
I didn't
about
need.
If you take me with you, I'll make sure you don't walk out with anything, because you have a new bike.
You and I are not good at supervising each other.
There's one other thing we wanted to mention is there is, we're working with a company called the Pros Closet. They're actually a reseller of bicycles, but they've been building a museum. It's a passion point for them. So they'll be bringing their museum and a selection of their bikes from their museum to our show. So it's going to be a mix of both mountain bikes and road bikes, and they'll be rotating bikes out throughout the weekend. So it's really the long history of frame building from their perspective, but some really unique one-off prototype bikes. If you read Mountain Bike Action back in the 80s or 90s, they probably have most of the cover shot bikes in their museum. So excited to bring them along too.
Okay, excellent. Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. We've got about 10 bike shops in this town, which you wouldn't actually know until you started thinking about it. Three main ones, or four main ones, White Pine, Jan's, Cole Sport, and Storm Cycle. Will those shops be there? Is this something that mainstream bike shops come to see what's going on? Probably because people who like bikes really like bikes.
It's a celebration of bikes. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. So anybody, you know, that's into bikes is welcome to come on down, check it out. Most bike shop will be sending employees or managers or somebody down there to see what's going on. Some of the main brands, including Specialized, are in Trek. Every year they send product managers out to the show, and they are looking at the bikes and looking at what developments the frame builders make, because frame builders really are kind of on the cutting edge of what's going on in the industry. So they'll see that, and they'll implement those developments into their next year's brand or next year's lineup.
Okay,
and
good
we also
to know.
Have the support of Shimano, Camp Ignolio will be there, Cell Anatomica, Reynolds, who is a local company, Envy is a local company, Head Wheel. So it's also not just frames builders, but also the products that support and are used on there. So a lot of the boutique, whether it's saddle makers, tool makers, but also major brands like SRAM and Shimano and Camp Ignolio will be there. So again, it's truly a celebration beyond everything that sort of goes into a bike, wheels and drivetrains and bars and stems. And
excellent.
Saddles
and tires too.
And tires too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don Walker, Steve Elms, the North American Handmade Bicycle Show taking place Friday, Saturday, Sunday at the Salt Palace Convention Center in Salt Lake. Thanks so much for joining us. Yeah,
thanks for having us.
And moving right into our final guest, neuroscience and cognitive science has come so far in confirming our suspicions about the power of the brain, and more information is now within our grasp about the true power of the brain. All we have to do is harness it. Our final guest is Frederica Fabricius, and she has co-written a book called The Leading Brain: Powerful Science-Based Strategies for Achieving Peak Performance. She's a neuropsychologist and executive coach, and she'll share with us science-based ways to improve and sharpen focus, break old habits, develop new ones, learn more efficiently, make better decisions, cultivate trust, and form teams in the workplace to improve overall performance. She joins us by phone, I believe, from Germany. Good morning to you. Welcome to The Mountain Life, Frederica.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, so great to have you, and I hope we didn't butcher your name too much, but we both decided you have the most beautiful name. Can you say it for us?
It's Frederica. Oh, no, I don't get it. It's Frederica Fabricius.
Okay. It wasn't too bad. We didn't do too bad.
You did a great job.
So, again, we've learned that science can prove what we've often thought about the brain, and you confirmed that in this book, talking about some new things. You're combining the powers of the brain with how to bring that, how to incorporate it into our daily lives, and especially in, the workplace, in teams.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Do you want me to tell you about this?
Please do.
Yeah, I work as an executive coach, and I have a background in neuropsychology. And for me, it's always been important to find strategies for my clients that really work. So I looked through all the literature and was looking for neuroscientific studies that really make a difference in people's lives. And I was surprised to see that there's so much we can do to feel better and to also be more high-performing. I can give you a few examples from the book. I think it's so important to understand that there's a biology to our cognitive performance. This book is about performing better, and there's one concept that I call fun, fear, and focus. And it's about the fact that we need those three ingredients to make our prefrontal cortex, the part of our brain that is important for rational decision-making, to make that part of the brain more performant, we need fun, fear, and focus.
Did you say fun, fear, and focus?
Yes. And I can explain what happens in the brain when we have these three things. When we're having fun at work, and I'm not talking about the after work party, actually while you are working, fun related to the task at hand, then dopamine is released in the brain. And when dopamine is released, we learn better, we make new connections in the brain, everything, information travels faster in the brain. So it's actually true that people who are having fun while working and who are laughing and who are in a good mood, they perform better. Interesting. You know?
Yeah.
If you're.
So we're getting a little, Federica, we're getting a little bit of feedback. It's a little difficult to hear you. So I'm not sure if there's something you can do to clear that up.
Oh, can you hear me better now?
That's much better. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I just want to ask you about that element. If we're having fun at work, dopamine is released, the whole experience is better. But this has to be an organic thing. You can't just sit down at your computer and open emails and say, by golly, I'm going to have fun doing this. You know, it can be contrived.
I think, you know, you can get fun through various channels. I think the most important thing is to choose the right job. When you are good at what you're doing, when you have a very high skill level, you usually have more fun. So, you know, if you're in the right job, your likelihood of having fun at work will increase. And I think the second most important factor is, are your colleagues and your coworkers. I think there's nothing more stressful than a bad boss or an annoying colleague. And you can't have fun at work if you are surrounded by people you don't like. So I think, you know, you need to choose something that you're good at, something where your talents lie, where your strengths are, and you need to be careful about whom you work with.
Can you give us some examples of companies who are putting that into practice currently? And I'm thinking in terms of, you know, kind of the obvious ones are, I think, Google, which has reconfigured the workspace. There are local companies here in the Salt Lake area. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Black Diamond, which, you know, when I walked into their sales floor one time, there were all these cubicles and there were dogs in every cubicle. And there's that, you know, sort of open environment where people are talking to each other, interacting with each other, and they're bringing their pets to work with them. And that's not only allowed, it's encouraged. And there's a difference between allowing and encouraging, is there not?
Yes. And I think I work with a lot of Fortune 500 companies, and I see the tendency that all of them are trying to change this. I think this has, you know, people are trying to make people feel better at work. And I can see that this is really implemented. One of my clients is EY. They have a big initiative where they really work on making, improving their leadership and making people enjoy what they're doing. Another one is ThyssenKrupp. It's a more traditional industry, but they're really implementing a lot of brain-friendly work environment things.
What was the name of that company?
ThyssenKrupp, you know, the steel company.
Oh, right.
Krupp, you maybe say. Yeah. I can see that across industries. I mean, the younger startups are doing this a lot, but I think even the more traditional industries are picking up on this.
So if we're having fun at work, we're likely to have a little sharper focus. But this is one of the things that you talk about is focus. And that's always a challenge for me, and I think for a lot of people. So what about focus?
Yes. I think from a brain perspective, when we're focusing, acetylcholine is released. It's a neurotransmitter that is important for focus and for learning, and it also makes the brain more efficient. So it's really one of the three ingredients we need when I talked about the fun, the fear, and the focus. You need that acetylcholine because it makes your brain more productive. And there are techniques you can use to learn how to focus better. One thing I really think helps is mindfulness practice. Mindfulness is about not thinking about the past, not thinking about the future, but being fully present here and now. And you can learn that by making small exercises every day that bring you back to the present.
Well, let's talk.
You can't really, yeah.
Yeah, I want to talk about some of those exercises because it seems to me that our daily lives right now, presently, are the opposite of mindfulness. I mean, we are encouraged all day long to have nothing but distractions. We are halfway through, writing some document and, you know, in comes another email and we have a notification that, oh, this email's here. So you're distracted and you open it. And so I would assume that some of these exercises are to counter that. But if you could talk about those.
Yes. You know that when people are distracted, it takes them plus 50% longer to complete the task, and they also make 50% more errors. Mm-hmm. Multitasking is really deadly to performance. One little exercise I really recommend to learn to focus, to not get distracted so easily, is what I call stop. What you do is you stop what you're doing, you take a deep breath. That's the T. And by taking a deep breath, you calm down your central nervous system, because when we breathe calmly, then our brain receives a signal from the body that you're relaxed. And then as a result, your brain will calm down and feel less stressed. And then you have the O for observe. So you take a moment to observe how you're feeling at the moment, if there's something you'd like to change, if you want to continue as before. You can do this in a meeting, or you can do this when you're all by yourself. It's not visible from the outside. You can just take a moment of reflection, and then you have the P for proceeding, and then you can either proceed as before or change something. So it's called stop.
And Frederic, what about what role does fear play? We have to get to the final F in your equation. And it's one that fascinates me because, you know, I don't see fear as a very often as a positive thing. It has negative connotations with me. I like to think of things in terms of hope and desire rather than and abundance rather than fear and scarcity.
I agree with you. And, it's an alliteration. If you have three F, it's easier to remember. What I mean by fear in this context is to be slightly over-challenged. We all need a challenge. When you're just bored at work and going through the motions, you're not going to achieve a lot. Because when we're slightly over-challenged, our brain releases noradrenaline. And noradrenaline is a neurohormone that is good for our performance as well. So we need these three ingredients.
You know, I'd like you to talk about those three ingredients. I don't know if they were all hormones, but you talked about things that were released when there was fun, when there was focus, and when there was fear. And
yes.
And so that's a biological response that affects the way that, I guess, you know, we express ourselves. You could say the way our genes express ourselves. You could say the way that our neurology expresses itself, and yet there's also this tie-in between what's happening in the head and what's happening in the heart, because you talked about mindfulness and taking a deep breath and calming down and being focused and present. So is there a connection between the two? And if so, you know, how do you perceive that connection?
Yes, I think it's very important to acknowledge that there's a body-mind connection, and it is a two-way street. People used to think that it's a one-way street, that we feel a certain way, and this affects our body, for example, our facial expression or our body posture. But in reality, it's a two-way street. So the way we put our bodies, or if we move our bodies, or if we change something in our bodies, such as taking a deep breath, this also has an impact on our brain. And then certain neurotransmitters are released, which are substances that help neurons to communicate with each other. And these neurotransmitters can make us feel good or they can make us feel bad. And the one thing I really, really recommend for everybody who's listening is exercise, physical exercise. It has a tremendously positive impact on our brain.
Absolutely. And we're finding more that that exercise needs to take place during the day when you get up from your desk, do a few burpees, a few push-ups, a little wall sitting.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We talk a lot about exercise on this program, and we're in a community that is very focused on exercise. But the previous two interviews that we did prior to this one, we talked about the role of art. And so I just want to bring art back into this conversation. Is there an impact in the neurotransmitters that occurs when people are exposed to art? Art could be calming. Yeah. Art could be inspiring. Art could be, you know, one of those not often highlighted aspects, because the exercise is an easy one. You know, we all hear, mm-hmm. you got to get out and exercise to manage stress. But what about exposure to art?
Oh, art does wonders to your brain, because when we are exposed to beautiful things or novel things or exciting things, interesting things, you know, novelty or beauty, our brain releases dopamine. And dopamine is really a brain booster. It makes nerve cells grow. It enhances transmission of signals between neurons. Dopamine is really something that makes us feel good as well. Dopamine puts us into a reward state.
Excellent. What was
so when you look at art, it makes you happy.
Before we let you go, and we've got just a few seconds left, when you are experiencing focus, there was a hormone released, and I can't remember.
Acetylcholine.
Acetylcholine. Okay, that was the first time I had heard of that. Acetylcholine. We'll look that up. Excellent.
Acetylcholine is actually very important for learning. When you look at patients who have dementia, they usually have a lack of acetylcholine. It's important for focus. It's important for learning. It's important for neuroplasticity, for the formation of new habits.
Okay, excellent. Well, Frederica Fabricius is our guest. She has co-written a book called The Leading Brain, Powerful Science-Based Strategies for Achieving Peak Performance. And we're so glad you could join us today. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And this is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
Hi, I'm Carolyn with Recycle Utah. Did you know that we offer a commercial paper shredder? It's located behind the mixed paper bin, and anyone is welcome to use it. Shredded white paper can be turned into 100% recycled content paper again. Fees do apply.
Recycle Utah is your community nonprofit recycling center since 1990 and a KPCW supporter.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weininger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. I want to thank our guests today, Julie Hopkins, Hadley Dynack, talking about arts and culture, and Don Walker and Steve Elms from the North American Handmade Bicycle Show. Again, that's taking place this weekend, well, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Salt Palace. You can go online to check that out. I think it looks great. It's use the acronym North American, NAHBS. com. And want to thank our underwriters.
Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Destination Hotels Utah, Park City Mountain, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, and Park Meadows Country Club.
And finally, our final guest, Frederica Fabricius, who joined us from Germany. And unfortunately, we didn't have a great connection there. But I did love the three things that she talked about: focus, fear, and fun. First, you have to have fun at work or in your life, produces dopamine. Fear is not really fear, but it's taking on additional challenges. And focus, of course, brought to us by mindfulness, which we practice on a daily basis, right? And this is KPCW Park City.